1 o'clock, you're tuned into KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno and KPFA.org. Please stay tuned now for Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Essentially, most of the problems come from the Clinton administration and his repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999. What happened is that these commercial banks that in the past provided these basic services, checking accounts and normal credit cards, have all become financial parasites by merging with predatory real estate lenders, predatory investment bankers, and they've become something entirely different from what they were 10 years ago. So the problem is that over and above, wrapped around these basic essentials that banks provide, they've all of a sudden taken on their basic identity from more and more parasitic, purely extractive activities that don't add anything to the means of production or to the real economy, but merely siphon off, rake off charges and fees for everything they provide.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, Obama's Republican Class War Presidency. Michael Hudson is a financial economist and historian. He is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trend, a Wall Street financial analyst, and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His 1972 book, Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, is a critique of how the United States exploited foreign economies through the IMF and World Bank. He is also author of The Myth of Aid and Global Fracture, The New International Economic Order. Dr. Hudson has written many articles on the current global financial crisis. A few of his most recent articles that we discuss today are Wall Street's Power Grab, The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission Hearings, Mr. Obama's Junk Economics, Democrats Relinquish the Populist Option to the Republicans, and the Bernanke Reappointment, Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid. Dr. Michael Hudson, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
What was your assessment of Obama's State of the Union speech?
Well, it's what he didn't say that's important. He stopped proposing the Consumer Financial Products Agency that originally had been the centerpiece of his financial reform. So he intends not to reform Wall Street in the lines that Elizabeth Warren had proposed and that he had promised to do after the $13 trillion bank bailout. Also, he was too shy to mention that he'd fought tooth and nail over the weekend to get Mr. Bernanke reappointed at the Federal Reserve so that he could continue to impose his anti-labor parties on the rest of the country. So essentially, what Mr. Obama did was relinquish any thoughts of playing the populist card to the Republicans. Now, that's pretty ironic. Nobody a year ago would have dreamed that the Bush administration, which people voted out of power overwhelmingly, would now be looked at as the friend of the people, more friendly, more populist, more consumer-friendly than the Obama administration. But Mr. Obama, by fighting to reappoint the right-winger, Mr. Bernanke, who has stated that his policy is to increase credit, which means increasing debt, raising home prices again, raising financial prices, untaxing real estate and finance, and shifting the tax burden onto consumers, this is a policy that George Bush never could have got away with. Imagine a year ago if somebody would have come out with Mr. Obama's policies, and the Democrats were in office, and Mr. Obama were a Republican, which basically he is. The Democrats would be protesting, but they're in a confusion now. They think, well, we have a Democratic president. We can't really oppose him. So this lets the Republicans pose as populists in sheep's clothing and make all of the arguments saying we're on the side of the people. Look at the Tea Partiers. It's politics turned inside out.
Are you then saying that Obama is getting away with stuff that even George Bush couldn't get away with?
That seems to be his role. At the point where the public had run out of patience with George Bush acting on behalf of Wall Street and the financial sector with the Paulson and Bernanke $13 trillion bailout, they needed a friendly face to do it. And the only way that you can continue to give more money to Wall Street and to the financial sector generally is to say that you're for the people, to do it with a friendly face, to smile, to be very adept and easygoing. That's the only way that you can continue to pursue an anti-populist, pro-financial policy.
Now, you just mentioned the $13 trillion. We all know that $700 billion constituted the TARP, that is the Troubled Asset Relief Program, of which some at least is being repaid to the government. But where does the $13 trillion come in?
This focus on the TARP is simply saying, look at this little amount, don't look at the big amount. For instance, the Federal Reserve has given $2 trillion worth of cash for trash swaps. The government has bailed out AIG for $185 billion. It's taken over the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for $5.3 trillion. Nomi Prince, almost every month, now updates the charts that she put in It Takes a Trillage online, and she gives a running total of all of the $13 trillion that actually began as much more. The Wall Street Journal last week came out with a $21 trillion giveaway, so that what the Obama administration has done really is triple the public debt. And that's why Mr. Obama said, okay, we've given so much money to Wall Street with this giveaway that we have to stop spending on the real economy. So he promises that next year there will be a 3-year freeze on government spending, on social services, on countercyclical spending, and on the kind of deficit spending that Keynesian economists said is necessary to pull employment out of recession. So essentially his message could be summarized, Obama to the economy, drop dead. He's supporting his constituency, his major contributors in the financial, insurance, and real estate sector against the real economy. And he's stopping it. And this is something that no Republican could have got away with without being thrown out of office.
Now, you said It Takes a Trillage. Now, I know she wrote a book called It Takes a Pillage. Is the pillage?
Oh, pillage, that's it. She kept changing. She kept changing the title. I'm sorry. Originally, it was Trillage, and she changed the pillage. I was remembering her original title.
Oh, I thought maybe that the pillage had segued into a trillage.
No, so obviously, she sat down with her publishers, and somebody decided that a pillage is better than trillage.
I see.
So I have to go with their decision there.
You say that the fix was in with the Democrats regarding the reappointment of Bernanke to another term of the Fed chief before Obama even gave his speech. How did you know that?
Well, he'd worked all weekend long, according to the newspaper. The Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, all said that he'd been calling senators, the Democratic senators, to say that he thought the Republicans might strike a populist pose in opposing Mr. Bernanke because he's so pro-Wall Street and deregulatory. So the problem was that a lot of the Democratic senators believed what Mr. Obama said, and they believed that he wanted actually to set up Elizabeth Warren's Consumer Financial Products Agency. Well, Mr. Bernanke had said that the centerpiece of his ideology was to oppose the Consumer Financial Products Agency. His argument is the old neoclassical junk economics argument that if you have truth in lending or other government regulations or anti-usury laws, this will increase the cost to Wall Street and they'll just pass the cost on to consumers. This shows an absolute ignorance of the concept of economic rent, the whole concept of classical economics, what every first-year student learns Mr. Bernanke pretends not to know. And he's just deliberately either lying or he'd flunk a beginning economics course. And nobody in the Congress stood up to him and said, what you're giving is junk economics. How dare you say that protecting consumers and truth in lending is going to make consumers pay more? Mr. Bernanke says anti-usury laws will make consumers pay higher interest rates. This is crazy. This is deregulatory sort of philosophy. This is Ronald Reagan and George Bush stuff. And the fact that he can get away with it and that Mr. Obama is supporting him should dispel any thought that Mr. Obama is talking straight when he talks to the people.
In an earlier article of yours called Wall Street's Power Grab, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission hearings, you say that Haiti's earthquake knocked the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission hearings off the front pages. What were those commission hearings?
Well, the Congress had started to have hearings on how was the $13 trillion of bailout money given away? What was happening here? And they were having really exciting hearings with key state prosecutors talking about the financial fraud that had occurred in Illinois, New York, Massachusetts, and how Mr. Obama had fought against prosecuting fraud, how he was defending the financial criminals, and how he was making it impossible for the government to stop financial crime. And just as they were testifying before these congressional committees, the earthquake in Haiti just took up almost the entire news hour of most of the television broadcasts, took up most of the papers, and so there was hardly any discussion in the press or in the media about the exposé of Mr. Obama's hypocritical action. And the state prosecutors were just desperate to let people know that Mr. Obama was on the side of the financial crooks, protecting them and taking his anti-consumer and anti-labor stance. That all came out in the hearings. All of this has been published, and I say all of the testimony that was given and some of the things that were said.
Well, yes, according to your article, Wall Street's Power Grab, you mentioned blocking the creation of a consumer protection agency.
That's now at the top of the president's agenda. He wants to make sure that when he tells people he's going to protect the consumers, he wants to make sure that Congress doesn't actually enact such a law, or that if Congress does it, the Senate won't pass it, or that it will all be sort of pushed out. And over the last year, the financial sector lobbyists have been very active on Wall Street, pressuring politicians to scuttle the law, and it looks like they've succeeded.
As well, in these Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission hearings, you point out that that they were exposing that he was going to avert any thought of reenacting Glass-Steagall.
That's above all things, that's the key. Unless Glass-Steagall or something like it is reenacted, you're going to have banks needing bailouts again and again and again because of the just the pure mathematics of compound interest growing and growing. This is why Mr. Obama very quickly, right after the defeat in the Massachusetts senatorial race, he trotted out the old Chase Manhattan, my boss's boss from Chase Manhattan, Paul Volcker, and had him stand by him while saying we've got to redraw these lines. But that's only for public consumption because Mr. Volcker had been sidelined for the last year, sort of put in the back office, nobody paying any attention to him, as the Wall Street Journal pointed out. And after there was that very quick attempt to make up for the losses in Massachusetts, you now hear very little from Mr. Volcker again. And the financial sector wants to make sure that there's further consolidation and across-the-board mergers to make it impossible for any government agency to move against them or to regulate them. And so nobody's really expecting any reintroduction of Glass-Steagall or any separation of powers between the financial sector, the insurance sector, and the investment and commercial banking.
Right, and I guess I should have mentioned that the main thing that Glass-Steagall did was separate commercial from investment banking.
Yeah.
Right. I read somewhere that someone was speculating that the reason that Volcker was given an appointment was that so he couldn't be a critic from the outside.
That's part of it. If you appoint somebody as one of your advisors, it makes it very difficult politically for the advisors to begin going out in the newspaper and giving interviews saying how bad your policy is. So what Mr. Obama did was appoint Mr. Volcker as an advisor, then ignore him, and that pretty much sterilized Mr. Volcker's ability to go and say, wait a minute, what the country needs is a Glass-Steagall Act, just the opposite of what Mr. Obama is promoting. So essentially, he neutralized any public relations and political effort that Mr. Volcker might be able to make. I don't think Mr. Volcker is a troublemaker in any case and wouldn't do it, but this just made sure that taking him on as an advisor is what I guess President Johnson said of J. Edgar Hoover. He'd rather have him inside the tent pissing out than outside pissing in.
That's right. I guess I read that in one of your articles about
right.
Volcker. I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, Obama's Republican Class War Presidency. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, getting back to Obama's State of the Union speech, you point out that, generally speaking, it's Obama's claim that Main Street simply cannot prosper without creating hundreds of Wall Street billionaires.
This is a wonderful trickle-down philosophy that he has. And that's the great myth, that somehow the host needs a parasite on its back or it can't live. Somehow that the workers and industry really need the rich people to get richer and richer because they're the people who create the jobs. This is the idea that Thomas Malthus of population theory fame had 200 years ago when he came out in his Principles of Political Economy and said, look, it's really good that we have a rich, idle landlord class because if we didn't have the landlords collecting all this rent, who would buy the buggies? Who would buy all the fine fashions? Who would employ all of the servants and the butlers and everybody else? You really need the richer. The rest of your economy would just have insufficient demand and you'd be in a slump. This essentially is the program of Mr. Bernanke and Mr. Obama. They say, we need Wall Street to collect all this money from us as debt service because if Americans didn't go further and further into debt, how would they make savings for the rich people that help build all of our factories? Well, obviously, Wall Street is not building factories. Wall Street is dismantling factories and moving them abroad to make money. So this whole trickle-down philosophy really went out with the Eisenhower administration, and all of a sudden, Mr. Obama, of all people, the Democrats, are reintroducing it. And to anyone who remembers what used to be said or who has a knowledge of the history of economic thought, this is just junk economics.
Well, yes, along that line, in another article of yours, the Bernanke reappointment, Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid, you point out that the wealthiest 10% of the population save most of their money. Their savings are lent out to the bottom 90% or gambled in derivatives or other zero-sum activities in which their gain, if they make any, is some other party's loss.
That's right. What Wall Street claims is, wait a minute, what builds all of your factories? What employs you? People's savings, and the economy isn't saving more. What we have to do is cut taxes on wealth and cut taxes on savers even more so that they'll have enough money to save and they won't waste it employing people or government spending on Medicare or government spending on public services or infrastructure. We've got to cut taxes on the rich so they'll have more money to save. Well, what they don't look at is the fact that gross savings are as high as they've ever been in the U.S. economy. They're about 18% of national income. But all of this gross saving almost is done either by the wealthiest 10% of the population, or it's forced savings by labor in the form of the Social Security and pension and Medicare pre-savings that isn't really available for spending. So So this money is lent out by the wealthiest 10% to the bottom 90%, or in the case of the Social Security and Medicare Trust Fund, the money's lent out to the government so that it can cut taxes on the upper brackets. So all of this is a kind of patter talk, an excuse to cut taxes on the rich, and essentially it's put the class war in business. So when the Obama administration and Mr. Bernanke and his other advisors say that we need more saving and more incentives for the rich, this is class war talk.
Now, you also say, with regard to his State of the Union speech, that instead of helping debtors, most of us, Mr. Obama has moved to heal the creditors.
That's right. Let's take the situation as it was a year ago when he took office. Debts were far in excess of the ability of most people to pay. For instance, one quarter of American real estate, not only homes by consumers, but also office buildings, is in negative equity. That means that people owe more of a mortgage on their homes or buildings than the property's worth. Now, under normal conditions in the past, for the last 4,000 years, when people owe more than they have to pay, the debts are wiped out. There's a transfer of property. One way or another, the debts are reduced to the ability to pay. That's sort of a basic mathematical principle. But what the Obama policy is, which is being pursued by Mr. Bernanke, is let's reinflate the economy. Let's give government programs to subsidize new home buyers to afford to bid higher prices for homes so that we can get this property out of negative equity so that the banks won't take a loss. But instead of saving the banks from taking a loss on these mortgages, they're telling people, don't walk away from your mortgages. Even if you owe more, whatever you do, don't do what Donald Trump does. Don't do what Tishman Speyer does. Don't do what any Wall Street and real estate owner did. And in fact, what Goldman Sachs did last week, they walk away from their mortgages when they're in negative equity, when they're not worth paying. Take the case in New York recently. The largest residential investment in housing in the United States is Stuyvesant Town, which was built after World War II by MetLife. They got CalPERS, the California Employees Union, the Church of England, and other people, and went to them and said, we have a wonderful deal. We're going to buy the largest residential development, and we're going to kick the people out. We're going to throw people who've lived there 30 years onto the street, despite the fact that these are largely public sector employees that live in Stuyvesant Town, just like your public sector employees in California. We're going to throw them out, illegally raise rent, stop services, and we're going to make a mint for you by doing this. So the Church of England and CalPERS said, that's a wonderful idea. Let's screw the renters and do it. Well, it turned out that the renters went to court in New York and said these guys are breaking the law, and the judge ended up fining Tishman Speyer, the large real estate investment firm, for its illegal actions. The mayor said, oh, my God, this is a crisis. If you apply the law to protect consumers, to protect renters, you're going to bankrupt all of these financial investors. The case is still in the court. Nobody knows what rent the people are owning. But meanwhile, Tishman Speyer said, we're walking away from the property. Thank God that although it's a $5 billion property, we only put $112 million of our own money in there. So we're losing it, but all these other guys are losing it. Thank God it's them, not us. Thank God that most of the loss, half a trillion, is the California workers. They've lost. The Church of England's lost $100 million. And other investors have also been wiped out. They've walked away. The way to cure the consumer problem in the United States for many homeowners would be if they would do just what Tishman Speyer and Goldman Sachs and other firms do and say, the negative equity, we're going to walk away from the house, we're not liable, give it back to the bank, and then we'll buy it back for 50 cents on the dollar, or if you're in Nevada or Florida, 30 cents on the dollar, and we'll save the money. Why should we pay the bank more than a property is worth? That's crazy. Wall Street wouldn't do it. Economic rationality says don't do it. The fact is that most homeowners do not act in the way the textbooks say an economic rational person would act. A few years ago, I think I've said it before on your program, bankers discovered that the poor are honest. That means that they believe they should repay the debts. This is like saying the poor are suckers, because Wall Street never pays its debts if it can avoid it. In fact, Wall Street tries to avoid putting its own money in projects at all and prefers to use other people's money, especially pension fund money or mutual fund money and Church of England money and California employees' money, and gamble with that. And that basically is what's been happening now. Well, the idea of the Obama administration and Bernanke is, let's reinflate the market. If we give more money to home buyers on easier credit terms, then they can begin to bid up the price of property and get the banks out of this negative equity situation, so that we can protect ourselves from homeowners acting rationally and just walking away from the property and buying an identical home somewhere else at half the price. That's what the whole real estate and financial issue is in the United States today.
Right. So what they're saying, what the government is saying, is that saving the system means saving the bubble economy.
That's what they mean. Not saving industry, not saving the industrial economy, but continue to save a bubble. And the problem with a bubble is it has to keep growing exponentially, because all of these debts, the mortgage debts and the consumer loans and the loans to students, all bear interest. And as the interest is paid to the banks turn around and they relend this out to find yet new borrowers. So they have to keep finding a wider and wider array of borrowers to take this credit on. And this means the debt grows all the more. And the debts grow faster than the economy's ability to pay. Something has to give. And at a point, the debts will be written down. And if you want a dress rehearsal of what this will look at, you look at countries like Latvia or Iceland, where real estate prices have fallen by 70%, where the government is told to close down hospitals, close down schools. The economy's bankrupt. This should be looked at as the dress rehearsal for what's happening here, because it's in countries like Latvia and the other post-Soviet economies where the Obama team has had completely free play to design the economies from scratch. This is the Larry Summers crowd of Rubenomics advisors, Geithner, Summers, and the rest, that had the free hand in deindustrializing Russia and essentially wrecking its economy and driving it bankrupt and leaving it in the state that it's in today. You look at what the Obama crowd did in Russia, in the Latvia, the Baltics, and the others that are now insolvent, and you'll see exactly the same game plan that they're trying to do for the United States.
I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, Obama's Republican Class War Presidency. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, you say that saving the system means saving a mess. Could you explain that?
The mess is the debt. The mess is the debt in excess of the ability to be paid. That if the government is going to keep going to the banks, as the Fed has done with $2 trillion and said, give us your junk mortgages, no questions asked, we're going to give you U.S. Treasury bonds for them so that your balance sheet is not going to have to take a loss. Well, then you're going to have bad private sector debts, these junk mortgages, and in almost every package of mortgage, you have consumer fraud involved. All of a sudden, you have the government, the Treasury, creating $2 trillion worth of government bonds, turning them over to the Fed, that gives them to the Wall Street banks and takes on the junk. That's why it's called a cash-for-trash swap. Well, that's what's increasing the federal debt. The federal debt is not increasing in the way that Keynes talked about, running a budget deficit and spending on infrastructure and hiring people to raise wage levels. It's done in a way that doesn't raise wage levels at all, but simply keeps the debt bubble growing, but it replaces the private debt with a public debt. So now American taxpayers, which doesn't mean Wall Street, are going to have to pay higher and higher taxes to pay the interest charges on this debt, and the interest charges are going to crowd out the ability of the government to spend on social services, on infrastructure, and that's exactly why Mr. Obama said, we've given so much to Wall Street, there's no money left for the people. There's a freeze, and that's why he said he wants to get the Republicans on board to make a bipartisan committee, which means the Republican committee, to freeze the budget. Well, the Republicans are smart enough to say, wait a minute, you Democrats have enough votes to do this. You control Congress. We don't want any part of it. We want to go to the people and say, hey, folks, we don't want a freeze. We're on your side. And stick the Democrats with all of this anti-labor, anti-consumer, pro-Wall Street action. So the Republicans are positioning themselves very nicely for this November's midterm elections to say that they're the good guys and to depict Obama's crowd as the oligarchy.
The claim is made that matters would have been worse if the banks had not been bailed out. What do you think of this claim?
They would have been worse for the upper 10% of the population that owns the banks. They would have been worse for the bank's stockholders and the bank owners. If the banks wouldn't have been bailed out, they couldn't have given these $100 million bonuses. They wouldn't have been able to give the money to the bankers that they've used to buy yachts, that they've used to buy the art market. There would have gone the art market. There would have gone the yacht market. Already prices in the Hamptons, where a lot of the rich people live, are going down. The economy would have been just fine. And this is one of the problems that immediately the Wall Street Journal picked up from the hearings on Geithner and basically Geithner and Bernanke and Paulson last Wednesday. The Wall Street Journal virtually accused them of perjury because Mr. Geithner and Mr. Paulson said, if we wouldn't have bailed out AIG, the junk insurance company, then there would have been a meltdown of the entire economy because AIG, being an insurance company, insures people's houses, and what would people have done about their house insurance and their car insurance? Well, the Wall Street Journal immediately on the editorial page quoted from testimony last year where the New York Insurance Administrator said, wait a minute, we have in insurance the equivalent of a Glass-Steagall Act. We've segregated the bread and butter operations of the insurance company, AIG, from their gambling operations, the derivative trade and the default swaps that are done mainly out of their London office. As a matter of fact, the New York Insurance Administrator testified, we have so much money that I was going to recommend that the New York branch of the AIG insurance people give $20 billion back to AIG of just extra savings they don't need. But of course, now he's not going to because he realizes that the kind of people that are in charge there. So the Wall Street Journal said, wait a minute, how can Mr. Paulson and Mr. Geithner say that they had to bail out AIG for $185 billion. Otherwise, there would have been a disaster for the consumers. It's all for the little guy. When you have the local consumer insurance administrator saying, no problem at all. These were well-funded, completely protected. So one didn't hear any response yet to last week's Wall Street Journal editorials, but they're quite right. Now, I think it's ironic that you have the nation's leading business paper that's exposing the pro-Wall Street distortions that the Obama team is making, Geithner and other people, instead of the usual left-wing press or the labor press, which has sort of been silenced by the fact as well, wait a minute, we don't want to say anything bad against the Democrats. They're supposed to be working for us, when obviously they're not working for them, at least the corporate Democrats are not working for the traditional Democratic constituencies, the labor unions, the consumers, and the other people who normally vote Democratic.
Well, right. Now, was AIG's insurance business really ready to collapse?
No, only the derivatives business to Wall Street, the gambling business, would collapse. And even then it probably wasn't, because these derivatives, the Wall Street Journal points out, nobody really knows what they're worth because there is no regulation of them. There is no regulation of them, and there's no public market trade. So there's no market price of these. Basically, you had Goldman Sachs say, we think these junk mortgages are a lot worth because it turns out that we've been insuring mortgages that have a lot of consumer fraud in it, because the government, and specifically Mr. Bernanke, has refused to prosecute consumer fraud. So we have a lot of consumer fraud on the book. So we think the mortgages that we've got swaps are worth, you better pay us $14 billion. Well, AIG said, wait a minute, they're not that bad. And in fact, it now looks like Goldman and other Wall Street firms want to pay much more than that for these things. They weren't all worth this. But the government said, whatever Goldman Sachs says they're worth, we're going to pay 100 cents on the dollar. Now, the interesting thing is there was another company that went bankrupt a few months before that the Fed paid only 20 cents on the dollar, but those weren't the Democratic campaign contributors. Those weren't the Obama crowd. They were people who didn't contribute to the Obama campaign or the other campaign. They were not paid 80% of the price. So the Wall Street Journal said, wait a minute, this is pay to play. This is what governors are going to jail for in New Jersey. These guys are crooks. And it looks to me like they have a pretty good case.
Well, right. And I thought, well, according to what you've written, AIG was actually paid 100 cents on the dollar.
Yep.
For securities worth about a fifth as much.
That's right. That's what the testimony was, and that's what the Wall Street Journal is saying. So the irony is you're getting all of this critique of financial crime from the business press itself, because they realize that American industry is stuck if they turn over control of the economy from the manufacturing sector, from agriculture. If they turn it all over to Wall Street, these guys are a gang. That's why Franklin Roosevelt called them banksters. That sort of gets the idea across. They'll take whatever they can get, and as long as they're in charge of approving whoever is appointed the financial administrator, they're going to insist that whoever is the head of the Fed be sort of a useful idiot like Mr. Bernanke, who really believes the guff that he's coming out about this trickle-down theory and deregulation and you have to let the market rule, meaning the Wall Street insiders are going to essentially be deciding how much the government's supposed to bail it out for. And this is what Iceland did on its way to collapse. There are a lot of dress rehearsals in recent times about countries that have gone down this route, and that's what America's going down.
So was it really necessary to not let AIG go bankrupt?
No, the best thing would have been, the economy would have been much better off had AIG gone bankrupt, and had most of these Wall Street firms gone bankrupt, including Citibank. The problem is that the people who own these firms, in Citibank, it's largely the Arab countries that have been putting in money, Kuwait and Arab republics. Nothing would have been hurt at all had this wealthiest 1% of the population lost some of its gamblers. I think I've said before on your show, in order to play the derivative trade, in order to have a hedge fund or to undertake these contracts, you have to sign an agreement saying, I'm rich enough that I can afford to lose all my money and I'll be okay. So the economy would have been okay. What has happened, meanwhile, is that the Congressional Research Service said that in 1979, the richest 1% of the population had 37% of the revenue from wealth. And by 2004, 25 years later, this proportion had gone up to 57%. In other words, 1% of the population in America has increased its take by 20 percentage points to 57%. Is probably about two-thirds right now of the wealth going to 1%. If you're going to have a democracy, if you're going to restore the kind of income and wealth distribution that you've had throughout most of the 20th century, the best thing that would happen would be to let the bad debts go, which means you let the debts go. Every debt has savings by somebody on the opposite side of the balance sheet, and these savings are mainly by the wealthiest 1 to 10%. The best thing would have been for them to lose all of their predatory taking. Instead, the Obama administration has come out on the side of the predators against the real economy, the production and consumption economy.
You've mentioned Obama's proposed freeze on discretionary spending, but Obama is not proposing to freeze military or homeland security spending. Why not?
Well, for one thing, he doesn't want to take on the Pentagon or the right wing. He essentially wants to get the right wing to support him because he realizes that as the economy shrinks more and more, as unemployment rises and living standards fall, the right wing is going to be his constituency.
You write that Wall Street is not the economy. It is a superstructure of credit and money management privileges positioned to extract as much as it can while threatening to close down the economy if it doesn't get its way. Does Wall Street play any constructive role in the real economy?
It does provide the means of payment, like credit card. It used to be that the government would provide the currency, and when people would go to the store, they'd spend currency. But now they spend credit cards, and Wall Street controls the credit cards. The government has let the money creation function and the money transfer function out of its hands to be privatized. So you have the credit card companies that are now charging up to 30% interest, and they make even more money on penalties and fees than they make at interest, even with their 30% rate. So you've given this sort of toll booth fee, this rent payment for money, over to Wall Street. Yes, people need to use some means of payment when they go to the store to buy groceries or buy other things. Wall Street supplies that. People need to have bank accounts. They need to have somewhere to save their money. Wall Street supplies that. But in the last few years, ever since Clinton, and essentially most of the problems come from the Clinton administration, not from Obama, not from Bush, but from Clinton and his repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999, what happened is that these commercial banks that in the past provided these basic services, checking accounts and normal credit cards, have all become financial parasites by merging with predatory real estate lenders, predatory investment bankers, and they've become something entirely different from what they were 10 years ago. So the problem is that over and above, wrapped around these basic essentials that banks provide, they've all of a sudden taken on their basic identity from more and more parasitic, purely extractive activities that don't add anything to the means of production or to the real economy, but merely siphon off, rake off charges and fees for everything they provide.
I'm speaking with financial economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show, Obama's Republican Class War Presidency. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, you mentioned that Americans could, if they so chose, walk away from mortgages that are underwater. That is, mortgages on their homes in which they owe more than the property is now worth. But I read in one of your articles that you say that Europeans don't have that option.
That's right. The American law is pretty unique. During the Depression, it's obvious that if you had people having to pay the mortgages on their homes, you'd have most of the American public in the 1930s would have had to pay all of their wage income for the mortgages. They would have ended up in debt peonage. So America and various provinces of Canada got rid of the personal liability for mortgages, just like a corporation or a real estate owner can walk away. Europe doesn't have anything like this. And almost all the European countries, if they don't pay their mortgage, they're personally liable for the difference between what the bank can get for the apartment if it forecloses and what the mortgage is owed. So I, for instance, talked to people in Latvia, and one woman, for instance, had worked for a charitable foundation there. She lost her job as part of the Latvian budget cutbacks, and she couldn't afford to pay her mortgage, so she tried to sell it. But the apartment was only worth maybe 30% of what she'd paid for it. She can't move out, because if she moved out, the bank would sell it. And a Swedish bank has the mortgage at a very low price, and then they'd have a claim against her income for the rest of her life for the equivalent of 70% of the house value that simply isn't there, and she'd be working the rest of her life to make the bank whole on a mortgage that it never should have made in the first place, because it didn't really care how much of a mortgage it gave, because it knew that it could essentially turn the mortgage borrowers, the homeowners, into a debt slave. So the girls tried to take in other women as roommates and still can't pay the mortgage. And this is a situation that's the case throughout Latvia, Iceland, Hungary, all of these countries where the real estate bubble has burst, and people owe a lot more than they can pay. The thought is that for the rest of their life, they're going to have to not only pay to live somewhere else because they will have lost their house, but over and above the money they pay, they'll have to pay for the old mortgage on their old house, and there won't be any money left to break even for food, clothing, or other. So Europe now looks like it's going into a chronic depression, and that's one reason that the euro has been going down in value, and why other currencies, no matter how bad the U.S. economy is, other currencies, sterling and the euro, have such even worse financial system that they're all going down together, which is why European and American money managers are all putting their money into Asia or third world countries where they don't have this kind of debt peonage.
Yes, you write that New Europe's debt strains are threatening to break up the core euro currency area. Could you explain that?
Well, right now, a condition of joining the euro by the post-Soviet economies and by Iceland is that they maintain a stable exchange rate between their currencies, which are still local, and the euro. They'd planned on joining in a few years, but now, all of a sudden, they're unable to pay their mortgage debts, and almost all of the mortgage debts and business debts owed by these countries are owed to banks outside of these countries. For instance, the Soviet economies like Latvia, the Baltics, didn't have any banks of their own when they achieved their independence from Russia in 1991. So they had essentially foreign banks came in. And the Swedish banks came into the Baltics. The old Austrian banks came into Hungary and Central Europe. And so these countries owe a lot of money to foreign banks. They can't pay. They're defaulting. And the only way that they can pay these banks is by borrowing from the European Union or the International Monetary Fund. Well, the EU says that in order to borrow, they have to cut back their spending on hospitals, cut back their schooling, cut back their public spending. And this is leading not only to economic shrinkage at home, but to emigration in Latvia. For instance, the lifespans have shortened by 10 years since independence. There were 200 hospitals at the time of independence. Last year there were 7. The IMF says that's too many. Now you can only have 3. You've got to stop your emergency service. There's no money. So in order to pay the banks, these countries are having just to act as brutally as a military invader would act. And that's why in Russia, President Putin said that the effect of the Clinton-Obama team has been as damaging to Russia as all of World War II. In World War II, Russia lost 20 million population. It's lost more as a result of the Reaganomics neoliberalism, more tens of millions of people than it lost in all World War II through shortening lifespans, suicide, declining health, heart attacks, brain seizures, diseases of economic tension associated with poverty and economic polarization. The effect of neoliberalism has been the effect of war. So the Americans, having won the Cold War, now want to destroy these economies and destroy the population, and the way they're doing it is through the same neoliberal policies that this team is now imposing on the American population.
Well, right. I was just about ready to say that's what they're doing to America as well.
Yes. So the anticipation is that lifespans are going to shorten here. You're already having either an emigration or the first line of it is re-emigration of immigrants, immigrants who came to this country for jobs, for instance, Indian computer programmers in Silicon Valley are moving back to India, Chinese graduates here in the sciences and biology and physics are going back to China. You're having a reverse immigration from here, just as in Iceland, for instance, the first effect of the austerity even before the Icelandic young people began to emigrate, was the foreign workers went home. Same thing in Ireland. Before the Irish have begun to emigrate again, they've sent all of the Baltic workers and the foreign workers home. So you're having this demographic effect beginning in the United States that you've already had in the most seriously indebted European economies.
What do you think of Iceland's refusal so far to repay the loans of the Icelandic banks that went belly up?
These were debts owed by private bankers, insured by a private banking scheme, and there's no reason at all for a public sector to be liable for private sector debt, so they're quite right not to pay.
And to sum up, what do you think overall of Obama's State of the Union speech?
It's a speech that a Republican president could have given, and it's a speech that is said just the opposite of what he was promising a year ago. What he'd promised was change, and what he's delivered is the antithesis of change. He's delivered, really, the third Bush administration, or you could look at it as the fifth Clinton administration. There's just a seamless continuity, not only with the policies, but with the very same individuals that were operating under the last two administrations.
What about the Federal Reserve's charter? Isn't the Fed supposed to be protecting the consumer and stabilizing prices?
The first part of its charter says that it's supposed to promote full employment and stabilize prices. Under Mr. Bernanke, it does just the opposite. Mr. Bernanke follows Alan Greenspan in saying, well, it only means consumer prices and wages. We do want to keep wages down. We don't want to keep housing prices down. We want housing prices to go up more and more, because when new homeowners have to spend more and more on their homes and more of their income to pay their mortgages, we call that wealth creation. Well, it certainly creates wealth for Wall Street and for the mortgage bankers, but it doesn't really create more money for homeowners as a whole. All that means is that the price that Americans have to pay for houses or for buying a retirement income, for instance, goes up and up and up. So the Fed has gone against its charter for that. None of this question was brought up in Bernanke's confirmation hearings. They were all treating him with kid gloves. And in terms of employment, obviously the way to spur employment is to minimize the amount of debt service that people have to pay so that consumers can spend more of their wage income on goods and services that are made by labor. And labor is supposed to buy what it produces. That's what the circular flow means. But under Mr. Bernanke's management of the Fed, more and more of labor's income goes to pay credit, and that is going to shrink employment. So, again, he's using a junk economic model here.
Isn't the attempt to keep the bubble economy going, isn't this putting the country in even greater danger than it was in, say, in fall of 2008?
The real danger is a slow crash. It's just going down and down and down and down. They haven't really made a new bubble. In fact, housing prices, as I mentioned earlier, are still about 25% below the level of debt. So what we're having is just a steady tightening of the debt screws. It's like driving a car with your foot pressed heavier and heavier on the brake pedal. It just is getting slower and slower. The unemployment rate is going up and up. The Obama administration promised that it would have only 8% unemployment if the Republicans voted for the stimulus bill. And you can imagine last week when the Republicans all pointed out, well, you said there was going to be 8% unemployment, and it's already over 10%. So they're making hay by pointing out that the economy is going downhill. And the irony is that the Republicans are now able to blame this on the Democrats. Nobody believed that that would be the case a year ago, but it is the case. And so the change that Mr. Obama has brought about is to make things worse and worse, not better and better. And this is creating a split within the Democratic Party itself, within the progressive Democrats, which are a shrinking proportion, and the old Democratic Leadership Council, the Clinton-Rubenomics crowd, that controls most of the campaign contributions from finance and real estate. So that's the split within the Democrats. And essentially, you're having a political split within this country, and it may even be that the old two-party system is being eroded or is going to be taking a new form in the next few years.
But I mean, by trying to keep the system going, they're just making it more dangerous, aren't they?
They're just adding to the debt leveraging, and that's going to just divert more and more revenue to pay debt rather than to buy goods and services. So there will be less and less motivation for new investment and less employment and lower wages.
And we're going into a depression, obviously.
Well, that's what it looks like. Nobody's able to say how we're going to get out. Let's put it that way.
Dr. Michael Hudson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Hudson. Today's show has been Obama's Republican Class War Presidency. Michael Hudson is a financial economist and historian. He is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trend, a Wall Street financial analyst and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His 1972 book, Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, is a critique of how the United States exploited foreign economies through the IMF and World Bank. He is also author of The Myth of Aid and Global Fracture, The New International Economic Order. He has written many articles on the current global financial crisis. Dr. Hudson has been a consultant to foreign governments, including Canada, Mexico, Russia, and Latvia. Visit his website at www.michael-hudson.com. That's michael-hudson.com. His articles are also regularly carried at globalresearch.ca, counterpunch.org, and the University of Missouri, Kansas City Economics Department blog at neweconomicperspectives.blogspot.com. That's neweconomicperspectives.blogspot.com. Guns and Butter is produced and edited by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako. To make comments or order copies of shows, email us at blfaulkner@yahoo.com. That's blfaulkner@yahoo.com. Or call 510-848-6767, extension 628.
It's about to begin, you know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call. So wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for a spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look within inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
Everybody go, moving down. KPFA wants Valentine happenings that are tender, deeper than chocolate, inexpensive, and thoroughly enjoyable by couples and singles. This year, Maxine Hong Kingston will read, and Hayden Reese will present two of his profoundly beautiful films featuring poets William Stafford, Robert Bly, Naomi Shihab Nye, Alice Walker, Coleman Barks, W.S. Merwin, Maxine, and others. Both films are soulful testaments to the sacred power of tenderness. This happens Sunday evening, February 14th, 7 p.m. at the Hillside Club, 2286 Cedar Street in Berkeley. There's wheelchair access plus worthy nibbles. Advance tickets for this KPFA benefit on $10 at our own bookstores or through brownpapertickets.com. Full info is on the KPFA website.
And it is 59 minutes after the hour of 1 o'clock, and you're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno, and you may also find us online at kpfa.org, KPFA Grassroots Community Radio, listener-sponsored for Northern and Central California. And now coming right up in just a few moments at 2 o'clock, it's